Invoking the next cycle of violence. History did not begin on October 7th. What took place that day followed more than 75 years of Zionist settler colonialism, and it was triggered by the unbearable conditions in Gaza amid the Zionist regime's 16-year siege and imprisonment of more than 2 million people in the territory. Most of Gaza's residents are the descendants of refugees who were forced to flee their homes across Palestine in 1948 in the face of rampaging Zionist militias. Gaza came under Egyptian control until 1967, when the fabricated regime of Israel invaded and seized the territory. The grip of Israeli occupation tightened with each year that followed, isolating Gaza's inhabitants from the rest of Palestine and the world. In the face of relentless Palestinian resistance, the Zionist regime withdrew from Gaza in 2005, only to impose a suffocating siege that has continued ever since. The truth is, the Zionist regime's occupation of Gaza never ended. It merely transformed. Today, Gaza is often described as the world's largest open-air prison. But even this description fails to do justice to the extent of Israel's brutality. What the Zionist regime is doing in Gaza is far worse. It is a project solely dedicated to the collective punishment of an entire population that has dared to resist. With more than 2.3 million people packed into an area of about 365 square kilometers and enclosed behind a high security electronic fence and concrete wall, Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. The Zionist regime's blockade looms over just about every aspect of life for Palestinians in Gaza. The Israeli regime controls who enters and exits the Gaza Strip with an archaic permit system routinely used as leverage over the entire population. Surrounded by Israel and Egypt, most Palestinians in Gaza have never been allowed to leave the enclave. The fabricated regime of Israel even controls its airspace and territorial waters. The blockade has devastated Gaza's economy and prompted what the United Nations has termed de-development, a situation in which development is not merely impeded, but actively reversed. This has left nearly half of the population unemployed, with the rate exceeding 70% among youth. For many Palestinians in Gaza, life is a struggle for survival. Between 2007 and 2010, the Zionist regime's authorities maintained a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional requirements to ensure that they only received the bare minimum of food to avoid starvation. And in just the first 6 months of 2023, nearly 400 children in Gaza were denied permits to go to the occupied West Bank for urgent health care. As if the blockade wasn't enough, the Zionist regime carried out protracted military onslaughts against Gaza in 2008 to 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, killing thousands of people and exacerbating already dire living conditions by crippling the territory's infrastructure. Homes, schools, and hospitals have been destroyed, while attempts to rebuild have been hampered by the Zionist regime's refusal to allow construction materials, such as steel and cement, into Gaza. In 2014, the Zionist regime targeted Gaza's sole power plant, aggravating an energy crisis that persists to this day, with an average of only 13 hours of electricity a day. While the physical carnage caused by the Zionist regime's brutal assaults has been extensively documented, far less attention has been given to the human toll and the psychological devastation wrought upon an entire generation. An 18-year-old in Gaza is now living through their fifth major Israeli regime assault. They have seen friends and family massacred by Israeli regime missiles, artillery shells, and sniper rounds. Meanwhile, 9 out of 10 children in Gaza suffer from debilitating conflict-related trauma. With children accounting for around half of Gaza's population, the future for many is bleak. The torture of Gaza, however, is only part of the story. Under the direct protection of the Zionist regime's military and with explicit encouragement from Israel's far-right leaders, Zionist settlers have carried out deadly programs in Palestinian towns such as Hawara. In recent months, entire communities between Ramallah and Ariha have been cleared out by Zionist settler violence. Even before October 7th, 2023 was shaping up to be the deadliest year for Palestinians since the UN started tracking fatalities in 2006. Across historic Palestine, the fabricated regime of Israel has been tightening its occupation and basking in the glow of impunity. Now, by remaining silent as the Israeli regime renders Gaza unlivable, the international community is condemning Palestinians to a hopeless future. Those lucky enough to survive Israel's unprecedented assault have nowhere to go. The Zionist regime's military has laid waste to much of northern Gaza, destroying half of the buildings and obliterating entire neighborhoods. Gaza's already overburdened critical infrastructure has been shattered, and after forcing hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee northern Gaza, the Israeli regime is now gearing up to turn its attention to the south. By allowing the Israeli regime to get away with genocide, the international community is complicit in creating a new crisis that will make the pre-7 October status quo pale in comparison. To call October 7th unprovoked ignores both history and the reality that people who have known nothing but the violence of ethnic cleansing, genocide, Zionist settler colonial rule, their entire lives would eventually reach a breaking point. The results might be grotesque, as all violence is, but they will never match the scale of the structural oppressive violence that gave birth to the cycle in the first place. What happened on October 7th was not a random outburst. It was the response of a brutalized people conducted in the language their colonizers taught them. This is neither an argument for nor against armed resistance. To the Zionist regime and its backers, there is no distinction. The Zionist regime's long history of crushing all forms of Palestinian resistance, both nonviolent and armed, is evidence that the issue was never the method, but rather the fact that Palestinians have dared to resist their oppression at all. For years, the international community has embraced the fallacy that the Palestinian plight could be ignored, swept under the rug.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Since the creation of Israel, the regime has tightened its political and economic grip on the life of Palestinians. In 1995, under the Oslo II Accord, an interim agreement was reached on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The agreement envisioned the establishment of a Palestinian interim self-government in the Palestinian territories. It divided the Israeli-occupied West Bank into three administrative divisions. Restrictions on economic activity in Area C of the West Bank have been particularly detrimental to the Palestinian economy. But Israel's continued attacks on Palestinians there, the demolition of their homes and businesses, uprooting olive trees and checkpoints, have choked the economy.
Israel has proposed zeroing out Egypt's debt, or portion of it, if it allows Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to resettle in the Sinai Peninsula, something that Egypt has rejected outright. You see, Egypt is currently mired in a debt crisis. It owes more than $52 billion to multilateral institutions, at least 44.7% of it, that is, which is owed to the IMF alone. Now, the other proposal that is thrown about is the forced Israeli transfer of Palestinians from the occupied territories of the West Bank to Jordan, especially since Jordan already hosts a large Palestinian population and it has signed a peace treaty with Israel. Apparently, that is why Amman announced recently that it plans to beef up its military presence along its long border. The Jordanian PM has said producing the conditions that would lead to forcible displacement by Israel is tantamount to declaring war on us. All signs in the occupied West Bank are pointing to Israel's intent. Since October 7, these are the stats. 3,200 Palestinians arrested, over 250 killed, more than 1,100 displaced from their homes, and in terms of demolitions, there have been more than 890 since the start of 2023, 139 since October 7. It's an open secret that Israel wants all of Palestine and wants all of the Palestinians out of Palestine. Israeli officials have come out back to back making suggestions on the forced displacement of Palestinians, which is a war crime in itself. The latest was the Israeli intel minister, who said instead of funneling money to rebuild Gaza or to the failed UNRWA, the international community can assist in the cost of resettlement, helping the people of Gaza build new lives in their new host countries. Now, this is ethnic cleansing disguised as humanitarianism. And finally, U.S. military assistance to Egypt and Jordan cannot be forgotten. Both countries rank in the top five when it comes to U.S. military assistance, which is another way for these two countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, especially when it comes to Israel. These figures show U.S. aid to Jordan, Egypt, and Israel. The amount of aid going to cash-strapped Egypt and Jordan is not something that the two countries can give up that easily, which is something the U.S. can actually use in the forced displacement of Palestinians as a temptation.
Weeks of relentless Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has raised concerns about the health situation there. The World Health Organization has warned that more people could die from diseases than from bombings in the Gaza Strip if the health and sanitation systems are not prepared.
Actually, we will see more people dying from disease than we're even seeing from the bombardment if we are not able to put back this health system and provide the basics of life, food, water, medicines, and of course fuel to operate the hospitals.
Critical infrastructure in the besieged territory has been crippled by fuel and supply shortages and targeted attacks on hospitals and the UN facilities since Israel launched strikes on Gaza on October the 7th. All key sanitation services have ceased operating in Gaza, which raises the prospect of an enormous surge of gastrointestinal and infectious diseases among the local populations, including cholera. For Gaza's 2.3 million residents, half of whom are children, finding drinkable water has become close to impossible. The WHO has recorded more than 44,000 cases of diarrhea and 70,000 acute respiratory infections, but real numbers may be significantly higher. Diarrhea increased by 45 times compared to the same period last year, and other diseases from respiratory infections to hygiene issues such as lice have risen. Almost three-quarters of hospitals in Gaza and two-thirds of primary health care clinics have shut down because of damage from hostilities or lack of fuel.
No medicines, no vaccination activities, no access to safe water and hygiene, and no food. We saw a very high number of cases of diarrhea among infants, and again, there was no treatment available for them. You know, if you have a child with diarrhea, you need to give them rehydration in order to keep them.
The health needs of the population of Gaza have increased dramatically, but they are now being serviced by one-third of the hospitals and primary care clinics. And with severe overcrowding, the risks are increasing for epidemics of respiratory tract infections, acute watery diarrhea, hepatitis, scabies, lice, and other diseases.
Health facilities in the Gaza Strip have borne the brunt of Israel's brutal war. Officials have described the situation in northern Gaza as catastrophic amid a lack of medicine and fuel.
The situation is very difficult. The patients, the injured, and the martyrs are lying on the ground. The medical staff is not enough, and there are no treatments. My brother is injured, and his condition is very difficult. We wait all day for treatments and medications. There are no medicines and medical equipment.
They say hospital beds are completely full, and wounded people are lying on the ground. Experts now warn the humanitarian crisis would deepen fast if Israel started bombing Gaza again, because people have been so weakened by almost 2 months of attacks. UN officials have warned that alleviating the crisis requires the urgent entry of additional aid and supplies in a smooth, predictable, and continuous manner to lessen the unbearable suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. Despite the temporary truce agreements between Israel and Hamas, officials in Gaza say no fuel had arrived for generators at hospitals in the territory's north. They say that without fuel, the territory could not pump clean water or clear waste accumulating in the streets, warning of a potential public health catastrophe.
Pursuant to the health status in the northern Gaza Strip, only three hospitals are still operating, but they cannot cover the health requirements inside the Gaza Strip, as these hospitals are small and there are 900,000 people left. In addition, the health situation in the northern Gaza Strip is currently desperate because of the inaccessibility of medical aid and fuel to the hospitals in the north.
United Nations Children's Funds is also working on creating safe places for children, but it needs a longer break in fighting to heal.
Threats to children are very much from the air and now very much on the ground. He was terrified as a medical professional in terms of the disease outbreak that is lurking here and how that will devastate children who are immune systems and lack of food already is making them perilously weak. Again, anecdotally, as a non-medical professional, when I'm in hospitals, it's children with wounds of war and it's children with gastro and who are sick everywhere. And I meet a lot of parents who are medical professionals or at least have master's degrees. They know exactly what their children need. They don't have access.
Meanwhile, UN reports that Israeli bombardments have destroyed or damaged 60% of homes in the besieged territory. It's said in Gaza City and North Gaza specifically, intense bombing has resulted in damage to over 50% of all buildings. The report said the strikes have also caused widespread damage to roads and essential infrastructure, such as power systems and distribution networks and water supply equipment.
Kissinger, influential American politician and career diplomat, has died at the age of 100. Kissinger served as both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under President Richard Nixon and continued as Secretary of State under Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford. However, he left a dark legacy ranging from supporting dictators and terror squads to directing coups and ordering war crimes. Kissinger is known for his role in carpet bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War, which caused the death of 150,000 civilians in a neutral country. The indiscriminate bombing campaign was expressed in Kissinger's infamous order to an American general when he said, quote, anything that flies and anything that moves. The civilian death toll in Cambodia was more than those killed in U.S.-led wars against several West Asian countries over the past two decades. Kissinger's genocidal campaign also enabled the rise of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge dictatorship. Yet, ironically enough, Kissinger was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for ending a war which he had blood on his hands. Kissinger was also involved in a CIA-hatched coup against Chile's socialist leader, Salvador Allende, in 1973. The coup was followed by a regional campaign of political repression and assassination in South America, dubbed Operation Condor. That resulted in the killing of 50,000 people, as well as disappearance and imprisonment of nearly 500,000 people in several South American countries under U.S. ally dictatorships. Kissinger also supported former West Pakistan dictator Yahya Khan, whose army carried out a massive genocidal campaign against Bengali-speaking people in East Pakistan that led to the 1971 war and finally the creation of Bangladesh. Kissinger's other infamous moves include his support for Indonesian leader Suharto, who invaded East Timor in 1975. Tens of thousands of Timorese people were killed in two decades of occupation initiated by Suharto. Kissinger also presided over a writing of a secret national security memo in 1974 recommending the U.S. government to force depopulation on third world countries to weaken their national power, ensure America's access to their resources, and prevent young population rising against U.S. imperialist control. After leaving government in 1977, Kissinger remained a prominent voice in foreign policy circles for decades. Even into his late 90s, he continued attending global events, consulting business clients, and privately advising American presidents. He has been lauded for his incredibly sharp memory and unique analytic powers, but his bloody record is a testimony that superior human intelligence combined with inferior moral sensitivities can be a source of incredible evil rather than good.
The U.S. has played a dubious role when it comes to its stance on the Israeli war in Gaza. On the one hand, the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken is said to want to press Israel to end the war in his upcoming trip to the region. This is while the U.S. President will move to grant Israel unfettered access to U.S. weapons stockpile. The U.S. President has also said eliminating Hamas is very difficult, but not impossible, which is part of the reason why pro-Palestinian protests have continued unabated around the world, since many see the U.S. key in ending the war. Many celebrities have come out in support of Palestine and against U.S. unwavering support for Israel, especially when it comes to military aid. U.S. actress and activist Cynthia Nixon has launched a hunger strike, calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., an unprecedented move by a Hollywood actress.
To have a hunger strike to get attention, but also to say, yes, we are bombing and killing Palestinians in that way, but we're also starving them. 7% of the nutrition that's needed for a population of 2 million people has been allowed into Gaza. And so certainly many people are dying from bombs, but so many people in Gaza are on the hunger, on the precipice of starvation. And so that's why we're having a hunger strike to reflect the horror of that.
She was joined by state legislators and activists also.
I think about how much anxiety and depression and fear and all those emotions that Gazans are feeling every day.
We have lost an entire society. Cities have been flattened. And if President Biden does not demand a permanent ceasefire, all of Gaza could be lost.
Israel is so afraid of the backlash. The Israeli lobby has offered $20 million to a candidate of Arab origin to compete with U.S. Senator Rashida Tlaib in the Michigan elections.
I was offered $20 million to withdraw from the senatorial race and run against my friend Rashida Tlaib.
As if that wasn't enough, the Israeli lobby is so worried about U.S. Congress dissent due to the war that it was reported it spent big money trying to purge its critics from the Democratic Party.
The pro-Israel lobby will go to any length to remove anybody from the U.S. Congress that has any opposition to their agenda, and their total unequivocal support for Israel, good, bad, or indifferent.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bazaar.
The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion.
Hello everyone, Ali Reza here, welcoming you to a brand new edition of Bazaar. This week, we are taking you on a journey through Iran's mammoth building construction industry while highlighting some of the country's recent developments in this sector. Plus, we will check out its market as a whole and the construction industry's contributions to the national economy. So, let's get started.
To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region.
This sector suffered a lot after the US withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits.
Now it's time to check out this week's special feature of Bazaar. So let's see where Sarah has been this past week.
In an ever-increasing technology-driven world, city streets are becoming more and more congested than ever before, while connected and autonomous technologies in vehicles are also on the rise. Such safety concerns pose a significant challenge for city planners and traffic engineers to improve mobility, safety, and efficient use of roadways now and in the future. We
When you are driving to work, or especially going on a road trip, you need to be fully alert to avoid the hidden cameras all across the road from catching you or costing you a damage. Well, sometimes this can be really irritating, but have you ever thought of the significant impacts they have in the most challenging situations? Today, we decided to take you to a company active in the field of intelligent transportation system in Sharif University of Technology. Let's go check it out. With creating intelligent transportation systems, the research and development team of the students in Sharif University of Technology has created a smart traffic software for processing related information. These smart systems are mounted beside or over the roads to detect motoring offenses, including speeding, vehicles going through a red traffic light, vehicles going through a toll booth without paying, or for recording vehicles inside a congestion charge area. All these violations are detected 24/7 using traffic data analysis system.
We as Kane Group started to work around 10 years ago here in Electronic Research Institute in Sharif University of Technology. Back then, our main expertise was focused on image processing and embedded systems and also IoT devices for smart cities and buildings. Our products are all knowledge-based and divide into three main categories. The first one is machine vision and embedded systems. The other part of the products are based on IoT or Internet of Things products. And the third one is the big data analysis and data mining. These products are all implemented on a secure and highly customized Linux operating system. Another line of our products are based on IoT devices, such as the smart gateways and actuators. We have exported these products to two foreign countries, and also the third line of our products are based on data mining and big data analysis. These softwares and products are mainly used in road maintenance and transportation organization and also some major municipality offices. These softwares help a lot in extracting useful patterns out of millions and billions data in traffic control centers and help managers and also managers and experts in traffic control sensors to extract practical and beneficial data from these smart cameras or sensors throughout the city.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this intelligent software was created for the smart camera system. When it comes to cameras, we have various kinds of traffic enforcement cameras, such as speed violation detection camera, red light camera, road safety camera, and so many more for plate detection. But that's not all. This company also creates IoT devices or Internet of Things. These are intelligent gateway camera systems for buildings and image processing with the aim of providing a better living environment for people and reducing energy consumption. Alright, now it's time to take a closer look at the smart camera system and see how it works. There are thousands of smart camera systems all across the country that actually function with the software created in this company. Now, let's take a look at one of the smart camera systems created in this company. Well, just like human, this smart system is created and is made of eyes. And if we delve inside, it's also made of a powerful brain. Well, the eye of this system is the industrial camera, which is created in different versions depending on the geographic location of the camera. For example, the one we have here has been created with a hardware design that protects against a heat wave. Anyway, this camera captures the images from the front side of this smart system and sends these images to the processing board, which functions as the brain part of this smart system. And finally, the data is transmitted from the intelligent software of the smart system to the traffic control centers all across the city.
The Connect Group was founded in some 8 years ago, I think. And the main focus of the group was on smart cutting edge smart technologies. for example, in machine vision, machine learning, artificial intelligence, data analytics, Internet of Things, and stuff like that. Later on, we use these technologies in more specific areas, for example, in intelligent transportation systems and various aspects of smart cities, like smart buildings, smart automation. And we have other countries around us that they are interested in some of our products. Our main goal for the future is to actually connect all the intelligent aspects of the city together. For example, if you have something smart in the in a villa or in an apartment, we connect it to the road, we connect it to the work office, and all these things all together to for one brain actually to decide for the optimization and improvement of several aspects of the these systems.
Employing the latest smart technologies as well as artificial intelligence, this company focuses on smart city and smart buildings, and ultimately, it aims at city management without human involvement. Presently, their products are available in almost 17 provinces in Iran. Traffic technologies continue to evolve and scale into solutions in mega cities. Finally, this paves the way to optimizing traffic flow and improving efficiency and safety on the roads. Well, there is no way to violate the traffic rules. The latest technologies in the modern world today, including the smart camera system, can detect and improve the wrong behaviors of drivers in the society. And by the end of the day, they can create a smarter, safer, and more sustainable transportation ecosystem. I've been Sarah Dema, and I'll see you next time.
We are getting close to the end of the program, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the construction industry and beyond. Iran is known for its creative experts in the field of engineering, so it is no surprise that last year the country exported technical and engineering services valued at nearly $2 billion.
That's based on Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. These services were sent to countries in Southeast Asia, North Africa, and neighboring regions. For example, 57 major infrastructural projects were carried out by dozens of Iranian companies in Iraq alone. Furthermore, the organization says with more planning and resources, the country can quickly increase exports of technical and engineering services to $20 million annually. In the last 15 years, Iran has taken on some 900 construction projects in 21 countries worth $32 billion.
Unconventional use of construction material. An Iranian architect has transformed a widely used construction material into a unique form of window. It is a type of spectacled brick that is a solid block with a circular aperture at its core which filters in the light.
The architect says the high density of buildings and city regulations in Tehran has limited sunlight exposure in office and commercial buildings. The developer explains the special brick in this project allows sunlight penetration even in parts of the building where windows are not permitted by city codes. Additionally, these unique windows can be adjusted to closed or open positions to optimize daylight exposure. The advantage of this brick is that it can absorb less air pollution and help filter out the noise from the motorways.
Increasing market reach. And let's conclude with Iran's efforts to expand its market reach and trade of goods with its neighbors. The country is organizing 6 exhibitions in the Qatari capital, Doha, that will be held during this year's FIFA World Cup event.
5 exhibitions will introduce Iranian handcrafts, such as hand-woven carpets, home decorations, and much more. Additionally, 1 will be held for construction materials and technical engineering services. This is significant for increasing bilateral relations and trade between the two nations. Government officials also say a direct shipping line has been launched between Iran and Qatar to help with the transportation and distribution of goods.
that wraps up our program for today. Also, if you have a topic that you're interested in, you can send us your thoughts and suggestions via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in and take care and bye-bye.
There is an enormous number of crimes in Rafah, Jabalia, Hizbet Abd Rabbu, Bet Hanun, Saafin, and Ghalia family on the beach. As long as there is occupation, there will be crimes. Such a fascist criminal occupation, as we see, will continue those crimes with no discrimination between kids, women, and men.
The continuity of massacres against Palestinian people is associated with the Israeli occupation that has been practicing a daily policy of ethnic cleansing in Palestine for more than 60 years. Hajjaj family from Ash-Shajaiya used to meet every evening to have whatever available food together.
We were sitting here around this area doing some barbecue on Saturday, July the 8th, 2006, around sunset time. Then the unmanned drone targeted us with three missiles. I saw my mother flying and falling down with her chair, while Rawan, who was sitting on her lap, was thrown 10 meters away by the explosion. I saw Muhammad jumping off the chair on the sand. Many shrapnels hit his back, and he died right away. I sneaked through an opening to the door and kept walking and falling till the ambulance came and they picked me.
21-year-old Muhammad didn't survive the shrapnel that penetrated his body, as well as his 50-year-old mother, whose bodies were cut into small pieces that are hardly recognized. 6-year-old Rawan, who did no harm to anyone, was killed too. Other family members who didn't die were injured and are still suffering the consequences of the crime after 6 years.
My uncle carried me to the ambulance. Then I was taken to Al-Shifa Hospital, undergoing several surgeries. I was injured in the arm and leg. I suffered a fracture and had internal fixation in my arms. I underwent several plastic surgeries for my arm. I had fractures in the joint bones and was advised that nothing can be done until I am older than 18. This means till the joint gets stiff. I was 14 years old at the time of the incident, and I am 19 years old now. And ever since the incident, I have my body full of shrapnels that I am suffering from. The most dangerous thing is the shrapnel in my head that I wanted to take out, but doctors advised that this would pose a risk, so it is still there while I am suffering from chronic headache.
Due to the severity of the injury, Ibrahim couldn't help it. Falling on the ground, he's still keeping the missile shrapnel that took the life of his family and left him with uncured wounds till now.
This plate was kept here with the parts of missiles that fell on our house, killing my brother, sister, and mother, and left me with a knee injury. I underwent a surgery. They fixed the knee internal fixation and told me it will be removed in a year. A year after, I removed it, but a while ago, it hurt me again. The acts of the occupation are evident. They are criminals, a state that's above the law. So it's not odd to be continuing those crimes. The rather odd thing is the silence and indulgence of the international community towards the justifications presented in this regard, as justifications are no longer acceptable when it comes to killing women and children. It's not acceptable morally, legally, or politically.
The Israeli occupation army never stopped searching for families to massacre. 4 months after Shijaiya massacre, Beth Hanun area was targeted at dawn, dated November 8, 2006. The artillery shells poured on Beth Amna family. The family woke up in a pool of blood. Some of them lost their life, while others lived to recall the testimonies about the unforgettable memories.
The Israeli occupation army targeted us with 14 tank shells. The first tank shell was like an announcement of their will to kill us. Due to the shell, all the room glass fell on me. I could barely through the sheet. Then we all were in the street. People gathered to see what happened. Then the second shell hit, injuring and killing people. I was injured right here by the second shell. The third shell finished everybody. Then all the shells were random, either to kill any person who was still alive or to follow those who were fleeing the scene.
This is the massacre scene. All bodies were laid here. The blood here was to the knees. We had to bury the area with sands while the blood was flowing outside to nearby places and all over the street. My son Arafat was targeted in this spot. They carried his head and arms without legs or body or stomach or anything. All of it became small scattered pieces besides the bodies of his brothers, uncles, and cousins who were all cut into pieces too.
The death toll among the Al-Athamna family reached 20 martyrs, most of them women and children. Umm Majdi Al-Athamna lost 6 family members, the last of which was her son Majdi, who died of a fatal disease he suffered after the loss of his son and brothers in that massacre.
I spent my life in more tragic events than the massacre. The last victim was my elder son, who lost his son, Saad. Majdi told me that he wished to visit Mecca as soon as he can, because he sensed his time is drawing closer. He wanted to perform Hajj. He did the Hajj, and after 20 days of his arrival from Mecca, he died. Can things get any more tragic? He had cardiac problem. Allah bless him.
The family at large consists of 64 members. 20 of them were killed, while 30 others were injured. So you can say that 90% of the family was devastated.
Al-Athamna family martyrs were buried in a graveyard near the buffer zone with the Israeli occupation in northern Gaza. The graveyard was targeted again during the Gaza War 2008-2009.
How are you, mother? May Allah grant you mercy. May Allah grant you mercy. May Allah grant you the paradise. May Allah make it easier for you. Even after they died, they were still targeted by the missiles of the Israeli occupation. Look how broken the graveyards are, how the missiles hit them. What can we do? You can't differentiate between people's graves. They are all mixed together now. They were broken and mixed after we built them. It's like they are saying, we are following you even when you are dead.
Al-Athamna family martyrs were killed twice. In 2006 and during the Gaza 23-day war, where a massacre was committed every day.
The night of January 11th, 2009 was particularly fierce. The shelling was heavy. Destruction and assassinations were horrible. We heard a cry for help from a wounded person asking Ziyada family to call ambulance. We tried to call but could never get through because all landlines and mobile communications were down. Then I tried to go and help that wounded person.
Ziyad Ziyadi answered the call of help and sneaked to the place where the cries for help came from, despite the heavy shelling that night.
I kept walking towards the voice crying for help till I reached the place to find a very shocking and horrifying surprise. The man crying for help was my brother-in-law and my nephew, both on the ground. Both of them were barely alive, but my brother-in-law was talking to me and saying, "I testify that there is no God to be worshipped but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger," while my nephew had a deep injury in the head and chest, almost fatal injury. We tried to call the ambulance for help, but our cries were never answered. The war was fierce in the area. About 3 minutes later, we were surprised by an Apache missile targeting the wounded people and shattering their bodies into pieces.
The number of Ziyada family members who were killed reached 5, one of which was a fetus.
My mother was 80 years old. My sister was pregnant and expecting a birth within a week. My brother-in-law and nephew were civilians who were not involved in anything. My mother, may Allah have mercy on her, was here. My sister, Suhaib, was sitting next to her, and next to them was Suhaib, while Abu Suhaib was dead and thrown in this area. I was injured and was here exactly. I was injured in the head and leg, and I had also some shrapnels in the abdomen and back. The martyrs and I stayed in the street from 1 a.m. till 5 a.m. when the ambulances arrived.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.